From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Oh, so much stuff to keep, so little room to store it. As the chief archivist of the United States, Don Wilson wrestles with the question of what to keep and what to toss every day. But when you're documenting a nation's history, the complexities, not to mention the curiosities, are astonishing. On today's Fresh Air, memory, space, and Elvis. Also, the life and fiction of Larry Heineman, like the protagonist of his award-winning Paco story. Heineman was an infantryman in Vietnam. On today's Fresh Air, Larry Heineman explains why the war still holds him. Also, high school kids talk freely about the pressures of growing up today. It's a preview of a new radio documentary from the Soundprint series. And Ken Tucker reviews the Michael Jackson video. That's all coming up on this edition of Fresh Air. There's a note that former presidential advisor Pat Buchanan wrote to Richard Nixon in 1969, urging him not to meet with the widow of Martin Luther King in Atlanta because many people, quote, believe Dr. King was the devil incarnate, end quote. This document can be found in the National Archives. My guest today is the archivist of the United States, Don Wilson. He oversees more than 3.5 billion documents that include things such as John Ehrlichman's doodles of Nixon, the Watergate tapes, Lyndon Johnson's Cadillac, the Army papers, the Vietnam War, genealogical records, Indian treaties, the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, and millions of feet of film. The records of the national government used to travel from capital to capital in the early years of the U.S. Franklin Roosevelt saw the importance of preserving these documents, so in 1934 he established a National Archives in Washington, D.C., and he appointed an archivist. In 1949, the Hoover Commission removed the independent agency status of the archives and put it under the auspices of the General Services Administration. This was for reasons of efficiency, but during this time, the archives were seen as merely old documents to be stored, and they were not properly tended to, so many things were lost or damaged. In 1985, President Reagan restored the National Archives to its initial status as a private agency, and in 1987, he appointed Don Wilson to be archivist, a lifetime appointment and the first presidential appointee of the National Archives since 1949. Wilson's an historian who's worked in several of the presidential libraries around the country. The business of deciding what to keep or not is of both historical and political importance. Wilson sees his job and that of the National Archives as an honest broker of history. I asked him to amplify a bit.
Well, that it should be non-political, it should be non-partisan, and it should be based on a secretariat kind of activity that takes the record-keeping out of the political specter.
How much repair to the National Archive did you have to do after the GSA had run it? I understand that because it was just viewed as kind of a giant garage and warehouse, there wasn't much attention paid to preservations of documents and paintings and so forth.
Well, we have developed a 20-year preservation program, and we are undertaking a very long-term preservation program, and part of it is the physical facilities itself, and I think the new building coming in the next 4 or 5 years will rectify the need for housing, particularly the modern materials such as film, videotape, electronic records, that we simply don't have the facilities to house at this point.
Did you go through the National Archives when you took over and went, oh my gosh, how could they have let this happen to this material?
Indeed. Having spent most of my career in presidential libraries, which are bright and shiny and new and lots of space, I was somewhat shocked, particularly when I got to the preservation lab and particularly the chemistry lab, which was in an old janitor's closet. Hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of equipment in this awful facility, and people just stacked on top of one another. So that was quite a shock for me.
Do you have problems with like mice in the National Archives?
Well, we have a few problems in the garage area, in the moat area underneath, yes.
The moat?
Well, we call it the moat, but it's the driveway.
Uh-huh.
And it goes under the building for the loading dock and area that there are. We have problems with rodents at night.
So do you set out traps or?
Yes, and for they don't get into the facilities itself. It's just the more damage probably to our vehicles than anything.
Now, I imagine presidential papers are a highly political issue. I mean, for instance, all the Watergate papers, the material from the Nixon administration has been subject to a great deal of litigation. Richard Nixon has wanted to use executive privilege to keep a lot of things secret, private. And I understand that you, as archivist, has to pass judgment on this?
Well, under the presidential or the congressional law passed in 1978 or 77, which 74, I'm sorry, took the records away. It created a new situation, and it's the first time that the presidential records were no longer considered personal property, and that's been a long and involved struggle. And then the question was that the Watergate material itself should be processed first and opened initially. And so that's caused a lot of the litigation. We haven't had that situation in other presidential papers.
The United States has a policy of declassifying many documents after a certain period of years and making them accessible to researchers, which is not always the case in other countries. There was a British author who wrote a book on British intelligence was prescribed from researching British archives. It was able to find much of the material he needed in our national archives. And when he published his book, Britain tried to suppress that. Do you ever get much pressure from foreign countries to control what kind of information people have access to?
Well, we actually try to take the lead as much as possible. We are by far the most open society in the Western world, and we take great pride in that, and I think one of the responsibilities of the National Archives is to provide access as soon as is reasonably possible. We have basically a 30-year rule. Some materials are open much sooner than that. Others can be exempted if it can be shown a very strong reason, foreign policy or otherwise, that it should be. But we do take some criticism from time to time, but I don't think we have anything that would be seriously challenged there, and we've worked pretty well with some of the countries. In fact, we try to encourage, conversely, we try to encourage them to open sooner.
Mm-hmm. One of the issues that that comes up often is how an American citizen can have access to a government document that is classified. And one of the programs I understand you're developing is a means of so-called sanitizing documents with digital imaging. In other words, sort of photographing them with the computer's digital images and then and then taking out what is classified?
Well, we don't take out anything. It's the agency itself that handles all the classification, and we are only the person who either says a request that it be declassified or we receive a declassified copy. While we hold classified materials, we only have the authority to declassify from the agency itself.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do the act of classification or...
So you aren't the ones who put the black marks through the photocopies?
No, absolutely not. We hopefully are the ones, in some cases, who take it out, but only with stipulated guidelines from the agencies. They, until they're 30 years old, really have control over whether that material is declassified or not, unless it comes through another source of an executive order or something. Then we can take action.
Why 30 years?
Well,
what is the 30-year rule?
Well, the 30-year rule really is the rule that says once a record has been in existence 30 years, it then comes under the control of the archivist and is taken over by the archives unless the agency can show a reason or agreement is reached that this would still be involved in some way in a national security activity or would have damaged international affairs.
Who is able to go into the National Archives and take a look through the letters of Abraham Lincoln or the Kennedy papers or to take a look at some of the trial evidence from the Nuremberg trials? Can anyone just go in and apply and examine these objects?
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
It's available to all people. Citizens of the country and in the presidential libraries and in the regional archives.
What breaks your heart to have learned has been lost from the archives or been stolen?
Oh, I think that the most serious thing is it's unfortunate that we lost so many materials prior to the archives being established, and papers were kept in such haphazard condition and records in various forms. Andrew Jackson papers, for example, were lost in the fire at the Hermitage, and other Lincoln papers sold off and by the heirs, and some purposely destroyed because they weren't under archival or government control. So we have lost many portions of our history. We, had it not been rescued in time, we would have probably lost the original decoration.
How did that happen?
Well, it was very prominently displayed. It was in the custody of several agencies from time to time, and often displayed, and nobody was particularly aware of the need for conservation or how it was sunlight and other factors would work over time to destroy the document itself. And so when it was transferred, both to the Library of Congress and then transferred to the National Archives in 1951, it has been, great pains have been taken to maintain no further deterioration in the Constitution and in the Declaration.
Well, I understand that the Declaration of Independence was actually missing for about 140 years?
Well, I'm not sure missing, but I'm not sure that everybody knew exactly where it was.
Well, glad that it's back. And
yes.
In place, was it under helium, I guess it is?
It is encased, and all oxygen or any damaging materials is kept from it, and we monitor it very closely and can tell if there's any damage at all being done to it.
Well, a lot of documents are now being produced electronically on computers, being kept on tape. How are you able to preserve some of this information, which is now so easily changeable? I would think this is an easy way for a government employee, an official, to maybe hide what it is it's been doing just by changing the nature of an electronic document.
Well, it's interesting, and it's a very serious problem, and one that we're really going to have to face over the years, because all agencies are moving more and more into the electronic area, businesses as well. We're losing, not only in the federal government, but through states, through private business, all forms of material being kept on electronic records, and the lack of standards, the lack of any way to really safeguard this, or even have a whole system wiped out by a magnetic field. It's not a very stable environment either. What we have found in most of our surveys at this point, and in the studies that we have done, is that the high-level policy material still is being printed out, or is in hard copy form. So I think that while the danger does exist in the future, I don't think we at this point have lost significant documentation.
Some of the documents that have surfaced in the Iran-Contra matter pertaining to Oliver North and John Poindexter, weren't these saved, in part the backup saved, as part of an archival program that Ronald Reagan had instituted?
Yes, in fact, they were. There were ways to retrieve that, and it actually goes into the system permanently. And it's not as easy to purge these as some people might think, although when they go more and more to independent systems and to disk activities, and it's going to be not only more difficult to ensure that they're saved, but it's also going to be more difficult to really know exactly what all is going on throughout a particular network.
Mm-hmm. What was your reaction when you heard Oliver North say, when congressmen were startled they'd been shredding documents, he said, well, that's what they provide shredders to us for. Did that sort of tear you up as a historian, knowing that all this rich material was going out in the burn bag?
Well, I can recall being out in Michigan and seeing it on the evening news, and I said, oh, I hate to hear that. It does, as a historian, really, or as an archivist, it worries you unless that they have been given approval to do so.
Mm-hmm. If an efficiency expert came to you and said, look, you're keeping entirely too much paper here. This is just too much. How would you justify to this efficiency expert why the National Archives is important?
I'm not sure. I would disagree that we're keeping too much, because I think we probably are. And particularly with the volume of information that's being produced today. However, I would say that without adequate documentation, without these records, we lose a very vital part of what democracy is all about, and that is having the actions, the documentation, the knowledge, and the accountability of what this government has done and what the people have asked and how the people function. And if we don't have that, as we have seen in some other countries, you lose a central part of the whole democratic purpose.
You know, I'm reminded of a scene in George Orwell's 1984 in which Winston is His job is to be in this giant room, some sort of a British archives of a kind, changing history, rewriting it, having people disappear and come back in again all the time. Are you conscious of some kind of a standard toward truth in your work?
Absolutely. I think that's very critical. And without it, we're in very deep trouble. I think we have seen that Orwellian activity go on in other countries with the disappearance and reemergence of certain leaders and the complete unavailability of documents. I think it's interesting that in the USSR, that the archives of the Soviet Union was under the control of the KGB until about 10 years ago. That, to me, is a very significant aspect of what freedom is about.
My guest is Don Wilson. He's the archivist of the United States. The National Archives, which he oversees, contains more than 3.5 billion documents and millions of feet of film and photographs. In addition to the Declaration of Independence and the Constitution, the archives preserves other items from our national memory, including eyewitness drawings from the atomic bomb test at Alamogordo, some of Lyndon Johnson's Cadillacs, the passenger list from the Lusitania, a wanted poster for Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid, and George Washington's personal expense account book. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is produced live at WHYY in Philadelphia and distributed by National Public Radio.
My guest is Don Wilson. He's the archivist of the United States. Do you find yourself collecting items throughout your life? Is your bedroom dresser cluttered with items you want to save? Or are you somebody who likes to throw things out?
Well, by and large, I throw things out, or at least my wife does. But we don't save historical materials as such.
No domestic historical materials.
Nor domestic historical materials. We have, been in a situation where we've moved quite a bit, and we have limited how much we save of any certain things. She finally threw away my college notes, I think, on the move before last.
Which did that pain you to toss them out?
It did pain me to toss those out, uh-huh. Yes.
Henry Kissinger sent his 15,000 pages of typescript of his phone conversations to the Library of Congress rather than to the National Archives. Why did he do that?
Well, I don't know as I have the answer to the motivation. I think the question and what was raised at the time was whether the archivist, the whole broader question of who determines what a record is. And the legal opinions of the time indicated that Kissinger, as head of that agency for the State Department at the time, could determine whether it was a record, a duplicate record, or whatever. And they indicated that these were personal papers, and he could put them where he wanted to put them.
So this made them then beyond the reach of the Freedom of Information Act?
That's correct.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Is there much rivalry between the National Archives and the Library of Congress about what kinds of material gets stored there?
I think over the years there's been some concern or cross purposes, but I know that certainly with this in the last 2 years that I've been involved, we have taken some major steps to rectify those areas of where we collect. And Dr. Billington and I have had several meetings, in fact, and have launched a number of cooperative programs. We both know and realize that we can't begin to do it all, and wherever we can assist one another, we will. So I think the lines are being drawn more clearly where there has been confusion, and I wouldn't call it rivalry as much as trying to straighten out and work together in determining who should best have it.
Did it bother you when the transcripts of Henry Kissinger went to the Library of Congress rather than the National Archives?
Well, I think as a policy matter, it created a great deal of concern. As at the point I was director of the Ford Presidential Library, it caused me even more concern because I wanted to complete the record there.
Mm-hmm.
fortunately, we did have an arrangement made between Dr. Kissinger and the Librarian of Congress, and with the assistance of President Ford, that copies of the relevant Ford or for the Ford years were are being made available to the Ford Library, so that record will be complete.
It seems
in, in a sense, we're getting it back into the National Archives then.
And then one day will also be accessible.
That's right.
To us all.
That's right.
Do you ever just sort of wander around the National Archives, poking into drawers and seeing what's there?
I wander around and talk to staff and find out who is there as well as what is there. Yes, I do. I don't do it as often as I'd like because as a historian, I would have one of my favorite places to go, for example, is in the still pictures and to look at some of those early Brady photographs and some of the Civil War materials. And it's just fascinating, and one could spend literally days there.
What startled you the most to learn was in the National Archives?
Startled me the most, perhaps, I think once I knew it, was I think maybe the captured German records and the OSS materials, and particularly the captured German records and how they came and what a fascinating collection that really is.
What is in some of those German materials?
Well, they include rosters of the inmates at concentration camps in Nazi Germany, hundreds of photographs of concentration camps, which were used as evidence in the war crimes trial at Nuremberg, which is how we ended up with the material. Also, we have a lot, more than 30 photograph albums belonging to Eva Braun, showing Hitler in a more informal setting. These are fascinating materials that it's amazing that they have been, you know, saved and preserved and available to us.
I understand that one of the most popular items that people order from you is a photograph of Elvis Presley shaking hands with Richard Nixon.
That's what I understand. It's been very popular.
So people just send in a note and say, we'd like this photograph?
That's correct. That's correct.
Was there any other account of the meeting between Elvis Presley and Richard Nixon?
Not to my knowledge. I think there was probably a appointment schedule book on it, but the main interest is the photograph itself.
I remember one of the facts that came out during the recollection of the Kennedy assassination was that President Kennedy's brain had been kept in the National Archives and then has disappeared. How could something like that happen?
Well, I don't know as it's disappeared. I think that the case is that it was removed to further purposes, but it it was really never in the National Archives. I think that was part of the whole question of some of the autopsy materials and other things, but it really was never put in the National Archives itself.
So then it can't have disappeared from it, I guess.
No,
then.
That's right.
Does anyone know where it is?
Not to my knowledge.
It's kind of like the Declaration of Independence, kind of just around somewhere.
Or why should we, maybe?
Yeah. Good question. Except that for a historian, it it might be of interest.
Well, I think the record would be. I'm not sure the physical specimen would be.
I know a number of curators of museums often put, you know, paintings from the permanent collection into their office. What do you have from the National Archives on display in your office?
Well, interestingly, I have one of the items is a painting of FDR, because the office was restored a number of years ago to the 1930 period. And so one of the paintings, large paintings that covers the wall from the Franklin Roosevelt, is from the Roosevelt Library. And they kindly permit me to use it in the office itself. But other than that, we don't have a large, significant number of items in there.
I was interested in looking through a book of items that the National Archive has to see, for instance, a draft of Franklin Roosevelt's speech to the Congress declaring war on Japan, which had, for instance, December 7th, 1941, a day which will live in world history, with world history scratched out and then infamy written in above it. This must be one of the pleasures for you as a historian, to be around these pieces of paper, these photographs, these watercolors that show you how people were thinking and behaving at a different time.
Oh, definitely. And I think in the case of many of these items, for example, in the Eisenhower, we have many original Churchill letters that were often edited or personal comments on them, Eisenhower's own speeches where he would edit, as well as President Ford and others that I have personally seen. To make those available, to show them to students then, I mean, it's really a laboratory, because the student, whether at college or high school, can come in, look at these original materials, and it's not just Eisenhower, it comes alive to them.
It's more
see
than
the
just,
original documents, right.
And it's not just looking at an inner office memo. I mean, these are the recollections of people's thoughts,
in their
doodles at the time.
In their handwriting, yes.
Mm-hmm. How long is your term? You're appointed by the president, right?
Yes, appointed by the president, but under the independence law, it's kind of a unique appointment in that I can be removed by the president, but reasons for such removal must go to both houses of Congress, kind of an implied life term.
Implied life term, rather than right. Like a limit of 10 years or something.
That's right. There is no limit on the term itself.
Uh-huh. So does this give you a feeling of comfort, of ease, of not being subject to political pressure then?
That was the intent, and it certainly does. I think it there's really a feeling of they know me. There is not a sense of mistrust or concern that there's going to be any kind of political favoritism one way or the other, and I think that's the balance that the archives needs and should have, and in dealing with the agencies as well.
There are a couple of different sayings on top of the National Archives. One is, I think, study the past, and the other is the past is prologue to the present.
Yes.
Would you consider adding a third to that, that says that the National Archives are everything the government wants to save that won't get it into trouble?
I wouldn't put that in there, because I think we save, and what is determined to get them in trouble or not get them in trouble is usually judged generations away, and I don't think we could even determine that at this point.
And that's the point of having the archives, is that
absolutely
generations hence will make these decisions.
Judgments and determinations, and let the record speak for itself.
Well, I want to thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today.
I'm very delighted. I would want to mention a new exhibit on American Voices, which opens March 3rd. It's an interesting perspective that it represents petitions, but not what government does for people, what we people ask of government over the years, over 200 years.
I understand the archives hold the air checks for All Things Considered in Morning Edition?
Yes, that's correct.
And so anybody can go in and listen to old ATC shows if
that's
they wish.
That's correct, and we'd invite them to do so.
Do you know whether Fresh Air is in the library there?
I'm not aware
that
it is yet. No, I am not aware that it is yet.
Well, I think they're running out of room here in Philadelphia.
Maybe we ought to look at that.
Thank you. Don Wilson is the archivist of the United States. I'm Sej Thompson, and this is Fresh Air. Next time, Terry Gross will be back from vacation to speak with actor and comedian Martin Short. Performing on SCTV and on Saturday Night Live, he created characters such as Ed Grimley, now with his own Saturday morning animated cartoon show, and the albino lounge singer and game show host Jackie Rogers Jr. Martin Short is now starring in the new film Three Fugitives. I hope you can join us.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Sedge Thompson with Fresh Air. When Larry Heineman returned from his tour as an infantryman in Vietnam, he said he was in a hurry to tell people everything that happened. That impulse led to writing, and in 1987, his novel Paco's Story won the National Book Award. On today's Fresh Air, writer Larry Heineman describes why his reaction after Vietnam was so different from most vets. Also, Waiting for the Great Leap Forward. That's the title of an upcoming edition of the radio documentary series Soundprint. In their own words, high schoolers describe the frustration of coming of age. Today, a preview. And critic Ken Tucker reviews Michael Jackson's new video, Moonwalker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news from National Public Radio.
I'm Sharon Green. The White House today announced an unscheduled news conference with President Bush 15 minutes before he appeared in the briefing room. The president covered a wide range of topics, from the Soviets and SDI to taxes and SNLs. NPR's Phyllis Crockett reports.
There have been questions all week about how long the president's no-tax pledge applies. He said he would like it to be a four-year pledge. White House spokesman Marlon Fitzwater described that as a hardening of the president's position since he had never discussed a timetable before. President Bush was asked about a Treasury Department suggestion that one way to raise money to insure SNLs would be a fee of 25 cents on every $100 deposited. He was asked if he thought of the fee as a tax.
Well, I'm just saying I'm not prepared to say what I think on it right now till I hear from it, because the more I discuss it, the more you all go out and say this is something that I'm considering when I'm not. It hasn't come to me yet.
In foreign policy, the president said he was being prudent by studying the options before making initiatives, and he confirmed that his first foreign trip next month will include South Korea as well as Japan and China. I'm Phyllis Crockett at the White House.
Solidarity Union representatives met with Polish government officials today to discuss upcoming negotiations on political and economic reforms. Solidarity leader Lech Wałęsa, a group of union activists and representatives of the Roman Catholic Church, held their meeting in a secluded government house in a Warsaw suburb. Following the 11-hour session, Wałęsa announced that long-awaited talks between government and opposition would begin February 6th. The governments of Japan, Britain, Italy, and France have decided to close their embassies in Afghanistan following the U.S. order yesterday to shut down its embassy in Kabul. Security during the final phase of the Soviet troop withdrawal there was cited for the shutdowns. The issue was discussed today by Soviet Defense Minister Dmitry Yazov and Afghan leaders. Lise Doucette filed this report for the BBC.
General Yazov has arrived a few days after Soviet and Afghan troops carried out a major assault against the forces of one of the strongest Mujahideen commanders in northern Afghanistan, Ahmed Shah Massoud. The attack marked the end of a tacit understanding between Massoud and Soviet officers, a secret accord which meant the Russians left Massoud's forces alone in exchange for allowing Soviet convoys to pass freely. But Soviet sources say the Russians have been trying to cut a wider deal with Massoud. They know he's capable of strangling Kabul by cutting the main northern highway. They wanted assurances that badly needed Afghan supply convoys would not be attacked and that Afghan security posts could be installed along the route. Massoud, who's been under pressure from other Mujahideen groups over his secret dealings, apparently didn't respond. He's unlikely to take this week's offensive lightly, although the present strength of his and the government's forces along the main highway is now unclear.
Lise Doucette in Islamabad. After a two-hour meeting with Yasser Arafat in Madrid today, Spain's foreign minister said the European community would try to speed up the process for an international peace conference on the Middle East. The Spanish diplomat joined the foreign ministers of France and Greece as representatives of the European community at the meeting. Arafat, who seeks recognition of the PLO, described the talks as important, positive, and constructive. At a news conference, he said he couldn't tell Europe what to do to help the Mideast peace process, but that it could play a fundamental role in resolving the conflict. The judge in the Iran-Contra case said today he has the power to require President Bush and former President Reagan to testify in the trial of fired White House aide Oliver North, but U.S. District Judge Gerhard Gesell said he has not decided whether that step will be necessary. Gesell issued the ruling during a court hearing dealing with numerous procedural issues before Tuesday's scheduled opening of North's trial. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials rose more than 31 points today to close at 2322.86. This is NPR in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Remember high school? Attending classes may have been the least of it in retrospect. I was walking through the hallways, daydreaming, hanging out at the candy store, and cutting school altogether. The Great Leap Forward is a documentary by independent producer Dee Roberts about what's on the mind of high school kids today, the pressures they feel, and the releases they seek. Roberts interviewed over 150 kids in Oregon and California. Her documentary will be featured on an upcoming edition of the Soundprint series. Today, a preview.
I don't believe that being 10 or 20 or 30 years longer on this earth makes a person automatically deserving of more or less respect. And I always thought that there would be some point when I would become an adult and I would become an equal with people. And I'm beginning to realize that there are all the games that you're always going to have to play all of your life. You know, these little, this person's ahead of you, you kiss up to them, and this person's below you, you can do whatever you want to them.
They want respect, and that's fine because I think everyone should be respected, but they don't give you your respect. And that's a major problem I have because I will respect anyone, but if they don't respect me, it's kind of hard to respect them.
They think that like we all just like hang around in the mall and talk on the phone and are really rude to people.
They eat potato chips all the time, they get zits and they're fat.
Drugs, driving.
I feel like I'm being regulated by my parents.
I don't really want my parents to care about me too much.
My mom's always expecting me to set a good example and stuff, and I think it's sort of rude of her.
Drinking, drugs. Friends, boyfriends.
Irresponsible.
Mm-hmm. Well, I feel that sometimes the reason that people think that we're irresponsible is because we want more freedom.
Some people suppress you, they haunt you, and reap a disaster, re-education for the infants who demand it for an innocent instant. A great
You'll get behind in your schoolwork because on the weekends you just got drunk like one night and so you were sick like the next day and then the next day you were too tired to do any of the homework. So you get behind in your schoolwork. So then you can't deal with that. And so you get stoned every day. And then so it just piles up and so things are worse and worse and worse. And to relieve yourself from that stress or whatever, you'll go and take some drugs.
Drugs and alcohol are the one subject you can talk about with, I mean, with every student I've ever met, I can talk about drugs and alcohol and have a conversation. It's a universal topic you can talk about. Everyone knows about it, everyone thinks about it, and most people do it.
Hey! Hey!
It's kind of expected, like around school, if you know somebody's been going out for more than a month, people just expect that they've already had sex.
Guys talk about it on the weekends, but if a girl talks about it and she has sex, then she's a slut.
Do you think you want to have sex now or later? Birth control.
Forget it. I won't do it.
In the heat of passion or whatever, you're not going to sit there and ask, are you going to use a condom?
There is no cure.
If you want to be treated like an adult, act like one.
Who defines adult?
We aren't taught to love ourselves enough.
You know you don't do that.
And you have to trust these people.
It's not a problem to me because I don't. I'm a virgin because I don't. Because I don't.
Right now, he's holding his own. With help from the drug AZT, he's survived longer than most of the country's 83,000 AIDS victims.
If I was going to have sex with someone, I want to know about who they've been with. I'm not just going to sleep with someone without knowing if they've been around or not. I mean, I want to talk about it before anything even happens.
I don't think most teenagers, I'm sure they think about it, but when they first meet somebody, they don't think, well, you know, they're cute, but what if they have AIDS? Because more chances are that a teenager isn't likely unless you're out on the streets constantly.
There's this thing when you're a teenager, you think that you can't die.
And I feel like we've had a miracle even with 4 years.
You think that you can't die.
So ask him what kind.
Can't die.
Planes were flying over the Mediterranean.
You can't die.
What a great play by the special team.
When I think of the 90s, I think of destruction. Some people are going to hit an all-time low, and we're going to see the lowest that we've ever seen before. But I think also, on the other hand, a lot of people are going to change and change within themselves, and that there's going to be a lot of good happening at the same time, and more good than we've ever seen before, too.
Since that's when we graduate, it seems like it's totally a new start. There's so much to look forward to in the 90s. I mean, it's our time to change things finally, and then we will have a say in our own government, and we will be able to say, hey, look, this is what we think's going on.
They say we're the future, but they want us to be exactly the same. And I don't understand that, because it seems like we don't have it worked out so that we can really make anything better. That's what it feels like to me, because we're sort of just placed in this weird mold. And once you get out of school, you go to college and you take a class in business and you go become, I don't know, it's just a lot of conditioning. I don't like it.
What are you worried about?
That I won't make it as whatever I want to become. That I won't arrive, that I won't get there.
People have been talking about, you know, we're supposed to be the future and you know, we're the youth or the promise of America and all this. And I feel like a lot of times I don't want that responsibility. You know, I feel like I was with my grandmother and a whole bunch of her friends that are, and you know, yeah, we made this mess and now you get to clean it up. And I felt like, you know, here I am and I'm in high school, and all last year I kept getting this stuff about you have to be responsible, make sure your friends aren't committing suicide, your friends aren't getting drugs, your friends aren't getting pregnant, your friends aren't, I'm responsible for all of them, I'm responsible to fix the country up. You know, it's all just, they're the youth and they'll do it because they're perfect, you know? And I don't want that. I'm responsible for myself, you know? I'm not responsible to get rid of nuclear waste. It's not my job, you know? And I don't like that idea that you're the future, so hurry up and be good so that you can take our problems away from us. I don't like that at all.
Dee Roberts is an independent producer based in Eugene, Oregon. The Great Leap Forward will be broadcast as part of the documentary series Soundprint, which is produced at WJHU in Baltimore and distributed by American Public Radio. This is Fresh Air. Twenty years after Larry Heineman came home to Chicago from his combat tour in Vietnam, he wrote, "I came home unceremoniously, and glad of that, feeling alien in my own country, separated by time and spirit and mind, filled with exhausted relief, immersed in the death taint." Since 1968, Heineman has become an accomplished writer about a subject he knows well, the Vietnam War. He's written two novels and numerous articles about the war. His novel Paco's Story won the 1987 National Book Award for Fiction. He's currently working on a nonfiction book about Vietnam vets who suffer an affliction known as post-traumatic stress disorder, a pattern of nightmares, flashbacks, and emotional numbing, leading to perhaps deep psychological problems, suicide, alcoholism, or drug abuse. I spoke to Heineman while he was in Philadelphia as part of a visiting writers program co-sponsored by Penn, the International Writers Organization, and the University of Pennsylvania. He told me that nothing in his background prepared him to be a writer.
I grew up in a house where there were no books. And there wasn't an emphasis on education. And I came to writing with a story. After I went to school after I got out of the service in 68 and got in with a bunch of writers when I went to a college. And those were the people who said, you must write the stories. Because I was not one of those guys who came back and went to their room and never said boo and have been eating my liver out for 20 years. Anybody who asked me about the war in 1968, I told them absolutely everything. I mean, it was almost breathless. I mean, I was just in a hurry to tell. And much to my wonder and surprise and great pleasure, found that I liked writing and was a good writer. So I knew I had a good story to tell, and it was just a matter of teaching myself to write. I mean, like grammar and punctuation. Mm-hmm. You know, I was never a very good student, so I really literally, I mean, I don't mean to sound like I'm bragging or anything, but literally started from a standing stop.
One of the recurring themes of Paco's story is the main theme, I guess it is his difficulty in adjusting to life back in this country after his time in Vietnam, the serious dislocation that he feels from being instantly transported from the squalid war into life back again in the United States where he's ignored. What has drawn you to this theme, and what keeps you writing about it?
Well, I think that it boils down to this. It was a year's tour in the combat infantry that I did, and the event had such a remarkable impact on my life that it's still a very powerful subject. And to write two novels about it, and I'm also writing a book of nonfiction about delayed stress. I mean, to write about something that is just so totally fascinates a person, I think it's the job of any writer. Any strong life experience is going to have an effect on a person in all kinds of ways. And as a storyteller, there's a great deal to talk about. I mean, it was a very complicated event, even though it was compressed into a year's time. And I've spent the last, well, now it's 21 years, really sort of mulling over what it was, culling through what it is like in this culture to be a soldier.
You've traveled to the Soviet Union to take a look at soldiers who fought in the Afghan War. What did you find? Was there a similarity in reaction to the Afghan War that you felt and found amongst others from Vietnam?
Well, first of all, the Soviet veterans of the Afghan War refer to themselves as Afghansi. I went there as a member of a group that was organized by an outfit in Seattle called Earth Stewards Network. And I went there to as sort of an adjunct research to the book I'm doing on delayed stress about American veterans. But the patterns of delayed stress among the Afghansi are just the same. There's a lot of bitterness toward the government. I mean, like, if the people in this country don't understand how amazing Glasnost is and Perestroika, these guys were just incredibly outspoken, like out front about being angry and bitter of being betrayed by their government, which is somewhat the feeling a lot of Vietnam veterans have. They have problems with alcoholism and not knowing what to do with all this anger that they have, which expresses itself in bar fights and stuff like that. And the Afghansi really haven't been able to educate the bureaucrats to respond to them. It took us a couple of days for us to get them to understand the word bullshit, just the plain old American word bullshit. And once they understood what bullshit meant, they started talking about the bullshit bureaucracy. I mean, so the Afghansi are in some ways going through the same process that we have had to go through.
Your book, Paco's Story, won the National Book Award in 1987. And it stunned the traditional literary world, expecting maybe a book by Philip Roth or Toni Morrison to win. Your book did. The New York Times came out with a series of articles questioning the choice and analyzing why your novel could have possibly won. And it struck me in reading over these old news articles that the reaction to your book winning was in very much the way Vietnam vets were treated when they came back from the war here. Like, why do we have to pay attention to this issue? Why should this be in the forefront of our literary life?
The book award was a complete surprise to me, too. I'm sure there were a lot of people in the room who were surprised, but the two most surprised people were Toni Morrison and myself. She was very elegant and to me the night of the book award. She hung around and I got to meet her and talk with her for a couple of minutes, and she was very gracious. And I was grateful for her, for the effort that she made.
But you don't feel that, or do you feel that?
Well, I think the point of the New York Times article a couple days later was the fact that Vietnam has been enough already. And let's start going on to other things. But under that, it was this. They were really apparently really angry that somebody outside New York had actually won the award.
I want to ask you one last question. Two of your brothers have disappeared. You don't know where they are. One of them disappeared after time in Vietnam. Have you thought about why he disappeared? And have you ever heard from him in the past several years?
No. Actually, no to both questions. My youngest brother and I both served in Vietnam. He was a two-tour Marine who dropped out of high school to join the Marine Corps. And when he came back from his second tour, he and I did not speak for about 10 years. So I really didn't know what was on his mind. He got married, had a child, and then he just something happened to him, and he got divorced and lost his job. That's not exactly nothing. And then he just took off.
But you were never able to talk with him about your times in Vietnam
together. He didn't want to talk about it. And he's one of those guys, I think, who he's lost. I mean, he's just lost. And it's a shame because he was a good guy. Now, there are a lot of guys like that who came back from overseas. And it's like Paco, you know. Something so terrible happened to them, and something that they don't even suspect.
I want to thank you very much for coming in on Fresh Air with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. Larry Heineman told me that after he finishes his book about war-induced stress, he'll set his next novel in his hometown, Chicago. This is Fresh Air. Coming up later here on National Public Radio will be All Things Considered. Host Alex Chadwick has joined us from Washington. I understand presidents, former and current, are in the news.
That's right, Sedge. My co-host, Robert Siegel, has put together a piece airing tonight that looks at the image of George Bush. Here's a man who's gone from the wimp of the nation to the attack dog of the fall campaign to a kindler and gentler president, the man just right for these times. Robert talks to political analysts and others to examine this transformation. Also, from the ongoing and about to begin trial of former National Security aide Oliver North, a ruling from the judge today that the judge has the power to call former President Reagan if he determines he needs him.
We'll look forward to the details on All Things Considered later today here on National Public Radio. Michael Jackson's new video release, Moonwalker, is being hyped as a major commercial event. 300,000 copies shipped to stores at $24.98 each for 94 minutes of what critic Ken Tucker says is mostly very familiar hits. I'm going to tell you right. I show you step up.
I don't ever stop. Can you get enough? Michael Jackson's Moonwalker begins just as you might have expected it would, with a Pepsi-Cola commercial starring Michael Jackson. For quite a few years now, Jackson has been simultaneously the world's most cynical rock star and the world's most innocent one. And neither of these characteristics is more dominant than the other. It's in their seesawing balance that Jackson retains whatever interest he still has. Moonwalker divides very roughly into three sections. The first is a sequence of Jackson in concert, performing material from his most recent album, Bad. You know, the one that sold over 6 million copies but is considered a failure because Thriller sold over 50 million. Anyway, while Jackson gulps and squeals the song Man in the Middle, we see him execute his by now standard set of amazing robot dance steps on stage. The next sequence is Moonwalker's most entertaining. It's a medley of Jackson's hits going all the way back to his childhood days with the Jackson 5, with the old music illustrated by new videos.
The best of these is a very witty claymation sequence built around less than one verse of the Jackson 5 hit ABC. There's also this quick recap of Jackson's career.
On July 7th, these five brothers will begin their summer tour of one-nighters at Madison Square Garden.
Yes, I'm the real Don Steele, and here's the Jackson 5. I hope you caught these kids on the Ed Sullivan Show last night.
From the fact of Stranger Than Fiction department, Michael Jackson has built a shrine to Elizabeth Taylor in the bedroom of his Encino home.
Singer Michael Jackson was admitted with severe burns to his scalp, as far as we know.
Michael Jackson. The Guinness Book of World Records has listed Thriller as the biggest-selling album of all time.
Michael Jackson has become the first artist in the history of music to generate six number one singles off one album. The album, of course, is Bad.
What Michael Jackson has achieved is a tribute to 20 years of hard work, energy, tireless dedication. Your success is an American dream come true.
Finally, there's a 40-minute mini-movie built around the song Smooth Criminal that does a lot to suggest the limitations of Michael Jackson's worldview. It starts with Michael frolicking in a grassy meadow with three children, one of whom is Sean Lennon, son of John and Yoko. There follows some sort of plot about an evil drug lord who wants to get Michael's three little chums hooked on dope. This is supposed to be scary, and it's certainly violent. One of the kids, not Sean, gets slapped around pretty hard. But what's truly scary here is Michael himself. The close-ups of his waxy face and the wormy curl that hangs down across one eye. His much-talked-about plastic surgery distracts from his acting, which in any case is limited to a lot of eye-widening and mumbling. There are tons of special effects and rip-offs of everything from E.T. to RoboCop, and at one point Michael becomes some variation on a Transformer toy, turning himself into first a car and then a spaceship. Moonwalker, addled and disjointed, was actually released in theaters in Europe and Japan. Over here, it's only going to take up shelf space at video stores. As a piece of popular art, its value is almost nil, but it's fascinating to watch at least once, to behold the spectacle of an artist at the height of his powers who's become wary of doing anything new, lest it disturb his stardom. He's now a prisoner of his own popularity.
Ken Tucker writes about popular culture for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Here's a look at the next Fresh Air. On the next show, we hear from detective writer Lauren Esselman. He's a former Detroit cop and creator of the Detroit sleuth Amos Walker. His 1984 novel, This Old Bill, was nominated for the Pulitzer Prize. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews Stories, a new album from trumpeter and flugelhorn player Tom Harrell. And television critic David Bien Cooley reviews the miniseries Lonesome Dove, based on Larry McMurtry's best-selling novel. So I hope you can join us. We thank everyone who makes Fresh Air possible.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced.
Our senior producer is Danny Miller. Our producers are Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, and Phyllis Myers. Production assistants from Ed Doherty and Lisa Bruton. Research assistants from Christopher Cook and Tim Jacoby. Today is Tim's last day with us. We tried to convince him not to return to high school for his senior year, but no luck. Our engineer is Thad Kirk. Chris, wait for my cue, Spurgeon directs the show. And these are all the keen-eared and good-humored people who get this show on the air and are a pleasure to work with. Terry Gross returns next time. I'm Sedge Thompson. Thanks for listening. This is NPR, National Public Radio.